All right, I call this meeting of Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:34 p.m. Friday, February 5th, 2021. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum today. Senator Bishop is here, Senator Stevens, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Keel, and myself, Chairman Rivak. Senator Von Imhoff has been excused today. And at this time, please silence your cell phones. Staffing today's meeting is our committee aide, Betty Tangeman, LIO moderator, Alex Banizak, and record secretary, Chris Dickrell, who is with us online. The purpose of today's meeting is to hear an update about the mineral industry from DNR. With us online for the presentation is Commissioner Feige and Stephen Masterman, director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Survey. So we appreciate you folks being on the line, your willingness to come here and educate us here today. Please hold your questions until I would actually ask the presenters, please stop periodically, maybe not after every slide, but if you could just stop periodically whenever you think is appropriate throughout the presentation to allow for questions, I'd appreciate that. And we'll get started right into it. So, Commissioner Feige, if you could please introduce yourself for the record and jump right into our presentation.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Corey Feige, and I'm Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. It's a pleasure to be back with you today. It was just a week ago that we were together to give you an overview on oil and gas, and in particular, North Slope operations and COVID impacts over the last year. We're here today, as you mentioned, to talk about the mineral industry, and presenting with me, as you said, is Steve Masterman, our state geologist and head of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. As we look back on 2020, from the perspective of the mineral industry and the mining industry, it was a bit different COVID experience than it was for the oil and gas operations. Overall, though COVID had significant impacts on oil prices and production globally, the mineral sector was far less impacted, especially from a price and market perspective. For the mining industry, it was by far worker safety and managing very labor-intensive operations and ensuring that we were able to keep not only the workforce safe, but local communities in which many of our remote operations function. The mining industry overall ended up staying pretty level and on par from a production perspective, but where we saw the greatest impact was in the deferral of exploration activities over the course of last summer. That clearly presented the greatest challenge. So companies deferred a lot of that exploration work just essentially to prevent the spread of COVID, as I said, in those communities and throughout those remote exploration camps. Specifically, Ambler Metals canceled a $23 million field program for last summer that they had scheduled for the Ambler District, and that was simply because the logistics of that particular operation and the experts that they were needing to bring in from outside, they did not believe could be done safely, and they believed that the responsible thing to do was to defer that work until the coming year. Peak Gold at the Tetlin project, they canceled their summer field program as well. But later in the season, we saw the announcement the 1st of October that Kinross has invested about $93 million in that project in a 70% acquisition. So even though nothing was done on the ground, great advances were made in moving the Tetlin project forward. Out at the Donlin deposit, they did stop their exploration work early in the summer, but then later went on to complete more than 23,000 meters of additional advanced exploration drilling. And that was all done with no lost time injuries and no COVID cases. So a big win for Donlin. And down in Southeast, we saw that Kensington also extended the time period, deferred their exploration work for a period, but later went on in the summer to complete their multi-million dollar exploration drilling program. And they and Greens Creek both adopted an approach, as did Teck at Red Dog, of extending the shifts for their workers. So rather than perhaps working a two-on, two-off shift, you'd be working 4 weeks on, 4 weeks off. And all of this intended to go hand-in-hand with those COVID protocols of testing and cohorting, just to ensure that there was no spread into our much more vulnerable remote communities. So all in, I would say it was a huge success for the minerals industry. We saw deferral of work, which we never like, but more importantly, we kept those communities safe and people healthy, and I believe we have a highly motivated workforce who will be back at it hard this coming summer. So from a prices and a commodity perspective, where oil and gas took a real hit, the minerals industry started 2020 strong, and we saw prices actually increase over the course of the year for gold and silver and copper and zinc and all of those metals that really are the cornerstone of digital communications and manufacturing of digital devices. So all in, we saw in some of our commodities, silver, for example, saw a 59% increase in the per ounce price over the course of the year. Copper was a 32% increase over the course of the year, and gold was up 25% over the course of the year. And just yesterday, gold closed at spot price on the futures was just over $1,700, $1,761 and some change. So we're looking forward to a continued robust pace in the minerals industry. We saw a lot of additional acreage taken under claim this past year, even though we couldn't get out on the ground. So I'd like to, at this point, hand the presentation over to Steve Masterman, who will walk you through some of the more details and the specifics on various projects, and then we'll loop around at the end and discuss the implications of the Biden administration and what it is we believe we see there for a policy direction and how it might impact Alaska's mining sector. So, Steve, I'll hand it off to you.
Great. Commissioner Feige, just 1 second. We have, a question from a committee member, but I just wanted to let you know we had some IT difficulties here. We can't get the slideshow up onto the projector. So if you could let us know what number slide you're on as you go through the presentation, we'd appreciate that. And Senator Bishop, did you have?
I just had a comment, and I wanted you to, Commissioner, welcome to the committee. And if I'm not getting the story accurate, would you correct me? But just for the committee's benefit and those listening at home, I, under these COVID challenges, I believe you put out a letter to on claim rental to forego for a year if you were COVID impacted. Is that accurate?
Yes, and thank you for that, Senator Bishop, through the chair. Yes, we did. As one of the actions that DNR took to help support the mining industry during this time, and especially our small miners, and we have a lot of them in this state, we did, in fact, place a hold on payment of lease rentals for the year, and we'll pick that up in September of 2021, so September of the current calendar year. And that, just like we assisted the oil companies with delay rentals on some leases there, we did the same thing for the mining industry.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Masterman, please.
Yes, good afternoon, everybody. For the record, excuse me, my name is Steve Masterman. I am Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, and happy to be with you all, at least remotely, this afternoon. So if we could advance to the next slide, please. And I believe this is slide 3, and it's titled 2019 Industry Summary. So this is a summary of the statistics from 2019 mineral industry, and we are currently compiling the results from 2020, and we should have those available later this year. But 2019 saw pretty robust growth in exploration expenditures and development expenditures, and the value of the materials produced were, and the estimated revenue to industry were all fairly stable. As Commissioner Feige indicated, the commodity prices performed quite well during the year. And there on the lower left, you can see a table that indicates the price at the beginning of 2020 and the price at the end of 2020 and the price changes. Now, as with many things like the price of oil and the stock market, metal prices took a pretty substantial dip in the March-April timeframe when there was a lot of economic uncertainty, and since then have rallied quite strongly and ended the year at these prices, as you can see, and they're in the rough neighborhood of those prices today. 2019 metal production is on the left of that table, and you can see the tonnage of zinc and lead and the ounces of gold and silver shown there. And those numbers place Alaska first in terms of zinc and lead production nationally. So we are the state with the largest production of zinc and lead. As the commissioner indicated, exploration expenditures, and perhaps less so, but somewhat development expenditures, was impacted by COVID-19, particularly early in the summer when people were still coming to grips with how to work around COVID, and that activity did pick up throughout the summer. But we do anticipate a drop in exploration expenditures from the $171 million that was recorded in 2019.
Mr. Masterman, we do have a question from Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Mr. Masterman. Just a basic thing for a humanities professor. Could you translate that ZN and PB into real things so I know what you're talking about?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I'd be happy to. So the top one, ZN, is zinc, which is the major producer of Red Dog is the major producer in our state. PB is lead. AU is gold. AG is silver. And CU is copper. And we do not produce copper currently in the state, but I put the copper prices in there because there are a lot of significant copper prospects in our state that are obviously looking economically better now with a higher copper price.
Thank you very much. I see Senator Click Bishop's eyes glow when he sees the AU. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Masterman. If you could, please, we're going to take a brief at ease to fix our overhead projector. So brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. Mr. Masterman, thank you for your patience. If you'd please continue.
Yes, just to make sure we're all on the same page for the record, my name is Steve Masterman, and Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. And if there are no questions, could we move on to the next slide, slide four, titled 2019 Fraser Institute Report. So the Fraser Institute annually compiles a report of the mining industry globally, and to see which jurisdictions are considered more attractive for mining. And they send this questionnaire out of about 15 questions to about 2,600 individuals and companies and compile the information. And Alaska typically does pretty well, and in 2019, the most recent report ranked fourth in terms of the most attractive, one of the most attractive jurisdictions globally. 83 jurisdictions were ranked, so we're 4 out of 83, which is pretty good. And in the United States, we were the state with the highest potential for mineral development. We also ranked very well, top U.S. state for mining-friendly regulatory and fiscal policies, and the U.S. state best able to meet its own permitting timeline, which is in no small measure to our Office of Project Management and Permitting and Division of Mining, Land, and Water. So those are all pretty good. There are when you dig in, there are a couple of areas that Alaska did not shine particularly well in, and one of those is the quality of our infrastructure, where we ranked 67th out of 83 jurisdictions, and I think that's just reflective of the lack of roads into remote parts of the state where many of our mineral resources occur. The one part of the survey that we at DDGS like to track is the quality of the geological database. And so being the geological survey, we pay attention to that. And in the 2019 report, we ranked 13th out of 83 jurisdictions, which is, we're getting better, I guess. It used to be lower, so it's nice to see us moving up through the pack. Next slide, please. This slide is...
Mr. Masterman, we have a comment from Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve, on that bullet number three on the Fraser Report, I know it says that we're the top U.S. state for mining-friendly regulatory and fiscal policies, but I'd also, you know, you didn't write the report, but I just want to make sure those at home listen and others that we are also the most comprehensive as far as protecting our environment. I know the permitting that I have to go through and the agencies that have to check off on each other and between Fish and Game, DEC, DNR, Corps of Engineers, et cetera. We have a very comprehensive permitting system, and it's there for a reason, is protect our natural resources and our environment.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Thank you. While we're on that, what do we have to do to become better in terms of the database? Is that something that's reachable for us? And what needs to be done, Steve, to increase our score there?
Through the chair, firstly, to Senator Bishop's comment, very good point there, Senator Bishop. I'm sure industry would be happy to go into great detail about the ins and outs of the intricacies and difficulties of permitting large mines. And Senator Stevens, I don't know that we have long enough this afternoon to really go into the ins and outs of that, but we are working to produce information annually that is digitally available, and modern data on geophysics and geology and geochemical information. And really, you know, the bottom line is it's the amount of resources available in comparison to the size of our state. You know, we are roughly 20% geologically mapped at a usable scale. We are roughly maybe 15% surveyed with airborne magnetics, and far less than that with other geophysical techniques. Our geochemical analytical database is probably roughly 15% complete. So there's just a lot of work to do. It's a big state. Working out there is not cheap, and there's a lot of work left to do. And you know, a lot of other jurisdictions have completed those basic data layers already, and that information is available to attract companies to explore and develop the resources there. So just continuing as we are, and you know, finding resources where we can to add to the data that we provide.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Masterman. Any other questions while we're on a pause? All right, please continue.
Yes, could we move to the next slide, please, which would be slide 5, titled 2020 Production Forecast. So here's a map of Alaska showing where the major mines are and our projected forecast for 2020. It's basically in line with the production that we saw in 2019. We don't see huge changes coming along. Some of the developments, though, that I'll talk about here in a little while will change the production numbers in a matter of a few years. For example, Fort Knox is production will start to increase as they develop the Peak Gold prospect down by Tok, and they anticipate an additional 200,000 to 220,000 ounces a year of gold to add to that total that you see there of 240. The Pogo mine is currently upgrading its mill and changing some of its mining equipment and its mining method. And they are doing that so they can increase their production to roughly 300,000 ounces per year. And so we will start to see the Pogo and Fort Knox gold production numbers increase as those measures that they're taking come into effect. Red Dog and Greens Creek have been operating mines since 1989. They are quite mature operations. And we see their production staying fairly stable. Typically, mine production goes up and down a little bit as they move from one area of an ore body to another where grades may change slightly. Are there any questions on this slide?
Questions? No, thank you. Please continue.
Could you please advance to the next slide, which is slide 6, and it's called Peak Kinross? So this is this slide talks about, and Commissioner Feige mentioned this, that Kinross has purchased an interest in a project down by Tok called the Peak Project, and this is a gold prospect that contains about 1.3 million ounces, and Kinross purchased a 70% interest for $93.7 million. And the plans are to truck the ore from this project down by Tok to the Fort Knox mill just outside of Fairbanks, where the ore will be milled and the gold recovered. So there will be no processing facility down by Tok. That, as I mentioned, will be done in Fairbanks. Kinross is working to conduct feasibility and initial permitting by the end of 2022. And hopes to be in production in 2024. And that production would continue for about 5 years and boosting the production, as I said, at Fort Knox by roughly 220,000 ounces a year. So that's great news, both for the Tok area, because there will be some good jobs down there, and also for Kinross and Fort Knox. Next slide, please. This is slide 7, which is the Pogo exploration slide. So just, I put this in. This was a discovery that was made a couple of years ago. just to the northwest of the Pogo mine site itself, and it's called the Good Pastor Discovery. And the discovery drill hole here was 17.5 feet of 54 grams per ton gold, which might not mean anything to anybody, but that is really high-grade material. The current ore grade at Pogo is about a sixth of that. So this is a major discovery. It's what happens when people understand the geology. And I think our hats should go off to the folks, the geologists at Pogo. They've started to unravel the geologic story there and are now making discoveries like this as a result. So right now, this deposit is about 2,500 feet long, or 2,300 meters long, and it's at a depth of about 500 meters and is open in all directions. So this year, the Pogo team had a number of drills working on this from the surface, converting some of the mineralization there into resource, and the understanding is that at some point, the Pogo underground mining will move in that direction. So this is really exciting, and I think it speaks to the future of the Pogo mine. It's going to be there for a long time. Next slide, please. So this slide should be slide 8, which is titled Red Dog Exploration. So Red Dog, as with Pogo, has had some exploration success, and I just wanted to highlight a couple of the deposits that they have discovered in the past few years. And these are called Actigaruk and Anarak, and on the right-hand side of this slide, you can see a map that shows their location. They're about 12 kilometers to the northwest of the Red Dog deposit themselves. And these are of interest for a number of reasons. They occur on state land. So if they become mines, then obviously the state would benefit financially from their development. They also are interesting because they will be underground mines. They are too deep to mine from the surface. They are very similar in grade and style of mineralization to Red Dog. So the assumption is that the ore will be trucked to the Red Dog mill and then off to the coast. And they are big. Anarak currently has a resource of 19 million tons of roughly the same grades as are being mined at Red Dog. But Actigaruk is a massive deposit. It has potential to hold as many tons as all of the ore that has been mined and all of the resources that are currently identified in the Red Dog area. So potentially up to 150 million tons. It's just a massive, massive deposit. So as with Pogo, we are greatly encouraged by these events and foresee mining occurring in this part of the world for many years to come. Next slide, please. So this slide is slide 9. It's entitled Mining Claims, and I put this slide in here to demonstrate a couple things. The blue areas you can see on this slide are where the state of Alaska mining claims are, so they are obviously on state land. The red areas on here, which are a little harder to see because they are smaller and not so numerous, are the federal mining claims. So as you can see on the right, there's about 3.4 million acres of state claims and about 125,000 acres of federal claims. Roughly 96% of all mineral claims are state of Alaska claims at this point in time, and I think that speaks to a couple of things. One, it speaks to the state's selection of its lands, in that we did a good job selecting lands with high mineral potential. And also, I think it speaks to the ability to develop the resources on the state land versus the federal land as well. So a couple things here to notice. And Commissioner Feige indicated that there was a considerable amount of staking in 2020. And one of the large blue areas on this map is one of those claim blocks that was located. So if you can see the Ambler area there in the Southern Brooks Range, there's two large blue blocks of mining claims, and the right-hand one of those was located in 2020. It's about a 200,000-acre claim block, and it is on an extension of the rock units that occur in the Ambler Mining District. They go along the southern flank of the Brooks Range, and there was a chunk of state land that they crossed, and the mining company located a very large claim block in there. Next slide, please.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, we have a question, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Messerman, maybe a couple of questions. You told us the blue and you told us the red. There also seem to be some green and orange blocks. What do those indicate to us?
To the chair, that's a good question. I'm going to try to zoom in onto my figure and see what the green and orange. The orange are, I believe, the federal claims. It may just be a kind of a color difference there. And I'll have to get back to you on what the green represent. I'm not seeing them on my screen.
Then, Mr. Chairman, one more while we're zoomed in. While we're zoomed in, the line from the Palmer Prospect goes to Yakutat. I think that's a little west. Was there something in Yakutat you wanted to indicate to us, though, that is worth a careful eye from the committee?
No, that must have gotten moved. On my image, the line goes to the blue area of mining claims just north of Haines, or just northwest of Haines.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, so I think that just must have gotten moved somewhere.
All right, thank you. Please continue.
This next slide is slide 10. It's called Active Exploration. And this indicates the active exploration projects across the state by the type of mineral deposit and the metals that it contains. So the yellow circles are gold prospects. The green circles are copper, gold, molybdenum prospects. The red circles are polymetallic, so those would be very similar to the Palmer project outside of Haines, and similar to the Greens Creek mine. So lead, zinc, silver, gold. And then there's some other oddballs on here. The silver, the tin systems out on the Sioux Peninsula, they are shown as purple triangles, and also out there is the Graphite Creek graphite deposit. In southeast Alaska, we have Bokan Mountain, which is a rare earth element deposit. And then there's a few other things dotted around on here. But I'd be happy to answer any questions about the sort of the level of activity generally around the state.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate your this map. Could you talk a little bit about rare earth elements? I mean, we're constantly reading national news about China producing most of the rare earth elements that we use. I can't tell where they are. It looks similar to where the tin, but where are the rare earth elements in Alaska?
To the chair, that's an excellent question. And Senator Stevens, if you don't mind, I will punt that one for a minute, because we are going to get into that in some depth here in the next couple of slides.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Please continue.
Can we move to the next slide, please? Slide 11. It's called Executive Order 13817. And here we're going to move a little bit away from the active or activity in the state and talk about critical minerals and some of the Biden administration initiatives. So Executive Order 13817 was issued by President Trump in December of 2017, and you can see there some of the things it calls for. It really addresses the critical minerals issue in our nation. It identifies the fact that the United States is critically reliant on foreign sources for a number of critical minerals. It established these objectives to meet the policy goal of reducing the nation's dependence on foreign minerals, and it indicated to the Secretary of Commerce that he had to produce a report to address the nation's reliance on critical minerals, to assess the nation's progress towards developing critical minerals in recycling and reprocessing, to develop options for accessing and developing critical minerals through trade with partners, and a plan to improve topographic, geological, and geophysical mapping of the United States to support private sector mineral development. And that's in part where my organization comes in. So in concert with this executive order, the United States Geological Survey produced a list of critical minerals, and we will be going into those in a moment here. Also, as a result of this executive order, the United States Geological Survey's budget was increased by almost $11 million to form a project called Earth MRI, which is to address the geological and geophysical mapping of the nation, and Alaska is benefiting fairly substantially from that. So if we could move on to the next slide, it's slide 12 called Critical Minerals. So this is a few things to note on here. I just want to define the difference between strategic and critical minerals. So critical minerals are minerals that you have to have for the functioning of your economy or the production, like the production of cars or copper wires or cell phones. Strategic minerals are minerals that you don't have. And so on this chart here, the critical minerals are off to the right, and the strategic minerals are off to the left, because this chart is a chart that shows the import reliance for those particular minerals. So the ones to the left, we are 100% reliant on. And the ones to the right, we are less reliant on. So also on this chart, we have shaded it to indicate which of these critical minerals Alaska is currently producing, which are germanium and indium from the Red Dog deposit. They're being recovered as byproducts there. The green shows what Alaska has produced in the past in terms of these minerals, so tungsten, platinum, chrome, tin, antimony, barite, graphite. And then the ones in blue are commodities that we have the potential to produce but are not yet producing. And then the ones in gray are ones that we feel that geologically we do not have a great deal of potential, so aluminum is one of them, potash is another, helium is another one, and so on. The questions on this slide?
No, please continue. Oh, yes, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for being very fundamental about all this, but I'm zeroing in on the potential future production. Are we in a good spot and compared to the rest of the nation for providing these this production in comparison to other states in the union? For example, looking at lithium, are there other production areas in the country that are already producing this? Or are we one of the few that could produce it?
To the chair, that's an excellent question. I think. Well, particularly with regard to lithium, the major lithium deposits in the nation are in the desert southwest, in the Basin Range country, in Nevada particularly. And so I think that they are better positioned to produce lithium. I think Alaska is well positioned to produce palladium, tungsten, platinum, tin, cobalt, rhenium, vanadium, bismuth, rare earth elements, platinum group metals, indium, germanium, gallium, graphite, fluorspar, arsenic, antimony. There's a lot that we have here, but there are some that are less likely to be produced, and we'll go through that here in a little bit further, more detail.
Thank you.
So If we could move on to slide 13, please. It's called Critical Minerals List. And this is a graphic to show some of the basic uses that critical minerals are used for. And here the boxes indicate the elements that Alaska has potential to produce. And in green, I've highlighted ones that are of sufficient economic magnitude, I guess is a way to put it, that they could or would be significant contributors toward a mining development. So some of these commodities are used in very small quantities nationally. I think there's one on this list, perhaps beryllium, that the total domestic usage is in a matter of hundreds of tons. And so some of these are not going to be very significant economically. But some of them are. And so just to go through this list of major commodities that we potentially have here in the state is uranium in the Seward Peninsula, rare earth elements in Southeast Alaska and through the interior and on the Seward Peninsula, tungsten is present in the interior, PGMs stands for platinum group metals, which is a group of six platinum group metals, includes platinum and palladium. Those are present, obviously, in Platinum, Alaska, and in the Alaska Range. Barite is present in Southeast Alaska and in the Brooks Range, and so on and so forth. So I think the point to take away from this slide is that there are major commodities that could be of significant economic value, and there are others that will be produced as byproducts from the production of more commercially significant commodities, like Red Dog produces indium as a byproduct, but Red Dog would not exist if they were just solely trying to mine indium. And I think that that's a key element to take forward, is that many of these will be produced as byproducts in small quantities, and the federal government is focused on that aspect of critical minerals production. And as noted here, of the 35 critical minerals, China is either the top supplier or the top producer of 22 of those for our country. Other significant countries are Russia and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And for this reason, the nation has obviously concluded it is in our best interest to source these either domestically or from friendly countries. Next slide, please. This is slide 14, titled Solar, Wind, Batteries, and EVs, which stands for electrical vehicles. So here what I've tried to do is look at some of the critical minerals that will be necessary to build the components of President Biden's green energy initiative and his transition to electrical vehicles. And so in yellow here are the critical minerals that are important for production of solar panels and wind turbines. In blue are the commodities that are necessary for production of batteries, and some of the ones that are necessary for electrical vehicles. And in green is where it's used in both of them. And then potentially significant ones in Alaska for us would be rare earth elements, tungsten, platinum group metals, titanium, chromium, potentially vanadium, cobalt, antimony, and graphite. And the other commodities that are shown here are or would be more likely to be produced as byproducts. And so hafnium and rare earth elements could come from the Bokan mine in a mountain project in Southeast Alaska. Germanium, indium, gallium could come from Red Dog or some of the other similar deposits. Zirconium could come from the Spokane Mountain or the heavy mineral sands on Cape Yakutat, and so on. We could go through the list, but this is starting to point the way to which commodities we have in Alaska that could benefit under the Biden administration. So any deposits that have these commodities in them and could produce them or would produce them as either major or byproducts could be viewed favorably by the Biden administration. I hope that speaks to somewhat to your question earlier, Senator Stevens.
Yes, thank you.
Next slide, please. So this is called co-location of minerals, and it is slide 15. And this map shows areas, well, it shows a couple of different things. And one of them, just in terms of the color pattern on the map, the red areas are areas that have a higher number of critical minerals that may be present. And so obviously the red areas are the areas that have the highest number of potentially present critical minerals. And so those are the areas that we are focusing our efforts on first. But also shown on here are some of our major mineral belts. And so the south flank of the Brooks Range, where Red Dog and Ambler are found, is shown there, and the gold systems on the Seward Peninsula, the Tintina Gold Belt that hosts Donlin in southwest Alaska and Fort Knox and Pogo Mines in the interior, base metal belts in central interior and southeast Alaska, and the Copper Belt is shown there that hosts Pebble and a number of other copper porphyry systems. So what we're trying to show here is that a number of different things. One is that if you provide information to benefit the location of critical minerals, then that information also benefits the location of any other mineral commodities that are present in that same area, especially as many of the critical minerals will be mined as byproducts of mining those other materials like copper and gold and lead and zinc and silver. And then also just basically what parts of the state are hot in terms of the critical minerals. And you can see here, Eastern Interior is pretty hot, Central Alaska Range is pretty hot, Western Alaska Range is pretty hot, parts of the Seward Peninsula, and parts of Southeast Alaska.
Yeah, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve, and that's only with 15% of the state mapped in airborne geological surveys, correct?
Yes. Through the chair, that's an excellent point. This is really a compilation of a report that was put together by the United States Geological Survey that covers about half of the critical minerals. And so, you know, this is showing us places that we should go to work to understand what those areas may hold. And so what we're doing here is prioritizing the state for the work that we need to do to increase the geological maps and the geophysical surveys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please
does that make
continue.
Sense, Senator Bishop?
Yeah, I got it. Yes, thank you, sir.
So, yes.
Senator Stevens.
Pretty fundamental here. Steve, appreciate your explaining it so that all of us understand this, but so I understand if you are a miner and you're looking for gold and you take the gold out, and but if you're not looking for rare earth or anything else, I assume that material is still there. So how does that work? Say in Southeast, you're looking for gold, you take the gold out, you've left the rest of the earth there. Can you go back then and reprocess that material for rare earth or magnesium or whatever you have not looked for? I think in fishing it's a little different where we have a bycatch, but so there's a similar thing here. there is sort of a bycatch, I think, and sounds like in mining. Is there a ability to go back and make use of the material you have not used, you have not taken out, say, rare earth? Can you go back and try and find it later?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, you have, I mean, you hit the nail on the head right there. There is a lot of work being done nationally and or starting to be done nationally to look at that very issue. And I'll be talking about that here in a little bit with regard particularly to some of the efforts that are being started by the Department of Energy to look at byproduction of minerals from current mine wastes, old mine wastes, for example, coal ash and produced waters from oil and gas operations or from mining operations. So that there's a significant emphasis being placed on this by the federal government. And it's very recent. It's in its formative stages, and I think it could be very beneficial to the mining operations, both current and future in our state. So we'll talk about that here in a couple of slides.
Thank you.
Next slide, please. And this next slide talks a little bit to your point, Senator Stevens. And this slide is called Mines and Advanced Projects and shows a number of the mines across our state in stars, and the advanced exploration projects are in the green diamonds. And this shows the primary commodity. For example, if we look at Fort Knox in the interior there, the primary commodity is obviously gold. But in parentheses there, it shows the other metals that are present in Fort Knox. So Fort Knox also contains small amounts of tin, tungsten, tellurium, bismuth, arsenic, and antimony. But currently, none of those are economic for the mine operator to recover. And similarly with the other mining operations around the state, there are not many that are recovering these smaller quantity elements. But if they were recovered, then they could meaningfully impact the domestic supply of these critical minerals. So this is where the Department of Energy is focusing a considerable amount of their research, or are planning on focusing a considerable amount of their research, so that perhaps they could work with Fort Knox to install a recovery system there to recover the bismuth and tungsten, so that they would be available for domestic to meet the domestic demand. So part of this is an interesting conundrum between the metals that are present and the economic benefits that are achieved by the mining company recovering them. So if a mining company mines a deposit that contains, say, small amounts of bismuth, but it's not economic to recover them, they typically will not, because it's not financially advantageous. But that's where the federal government may step in and provide grants or subsidies to facilitate their recovery for the national effort, if you will. So on the lower left there, there's a little chart that shows the critical minerals list, and the ones shaded in sort of an orangey color are the ones that are present in our mines and our advanced projects. And you can see that that is the majority of the critical minerals list. And so having this research and development being done by the Department of Energy could be of some benefit to our current operations and our future mines.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, second. We have a question from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Masterman, I guess the question then in my mind becomes, is there are there better and worse ways to retain some of the economic potential in these minerals? I mean, if you paste back fill your tailings, then the mineral's not going anywhere, but it's expensive to get it back out again and grind it up. If you put it on a on a tailings heap. I mean, it's been too long since I took chemistry to remember which of these, you know, potential things are water soluble or not. I'm pretty sure the bismuth is because they make Maalox out of it. But are you going to lose a lot of this storing it the cheaper way? What's the thinking in the mining industry for preserving this potential value or not?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that's an excellent question. There's a number of comments I would make to that. Obviously, the fewer times you have to handle it, the better, the cheaper. So if you can recover the metals the first time they go through the recovery plant, that's the best time to do it. You know, since these are marginally economic commodities, it's going to be very difficult to re-mine something economically if it doesn't pay to get it out the first time you handle it. So that's one comment to make. That's why the Department of Energy is looking at developing projects to recover the metals as they go through the processing plant. But they're also looking at technologies to recover metals from any solutions or from re-mining of previously mined waste. So, for example, if you have an old stockpile that, you know, water gets in and runs through and comes out, and that water has to be treated before it could be disposed of, then perhaps those waters could contain critical metals that can be recovered. And so they're paying a lot of attention to the recovery and treatment of acid mine drainage and of waters that are being produced from active mining operations of many kinds. Hopefully that answers your question, at least partially anyway.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go.
So I think, Mr. Masterman, what I'm hearing in this reply is that we might have the potential to add some of these things to existing mines later, but we aren't sitting on heaps of recoverable stuff that we just didn't get to the first time around.
Yeah, through the chair, I say, generally speaking, that's the case. There may be some exceptions to that, but I think generally speaking, yes.
Any other questions? All right, thank you, Mr. Masterman. Please continue.
Next slide, please. It's slide 17, titled Earth MRI Geophysics. And this slide speaks to, in part to Senator Stevens' question about, you know, what we are doing to increase our geologic database. So as I mentioned, the Earth MRI project within the United States Geological Survey was funded at about $11 million a year, and Alaska is one of four regions of the country that is benefiting from those funds. And so of the $11 million, Alaska has been receiving somewhere between $1.2 and $1.5 million a year for the last 3 years to conduct geophysical mapping, geological mapping, and geochemical analyses. And so based on some of the previous maps, the eastern interior has been highlighted as the area that we decided to work first. And that we call that the Yukon Town Upland. It's basically the areas of upland between the Yukon and the Tanana Rivers. And what this map here shows are the coverages of our geophysical surveys. The areas in green have already been covered by geophysical surveys, and the other colors are areas that we have under contract to fly with geophysics. So the area in the center in yellow was under contract from our funds we received in 2019. The areas on either side of that in blue are contracted with the funding we received in 2020, and the area that's got the light blue outline is the area that we are planning to contract in 2021 with the next tranche of funding that we are currently working with the USGS on. So The area in pink is an area in the around the Pogo district that was flown with a helicopter this past summer. We just published the results of those surveys, and this was a combined survey that was partially funded by a capital project that we received from the legislature in 2019, and also about $300,000 of industry money that they contributed to fly some areas in particular detail that they were interested in. So, like I say, that's been released. And once we complete these other large surveys, we will effectively have completed the flying of airborne geophysics over the Yukon-Tanana upland. And then we will be moving on in future years to another part of the state. And that part of the next area that we are considering is likely the Seward Peninsula. We do have to circle the wagons with our advisory board and with industry and make sure that that's the area that the collective wisdom is to move into. One of the other things that we are doing here that is really exciting is that we are reanalyzing all of the stream sediment data that the USGS collected during the NURI campaign in the 70s, I believe it was, and we're reanalyzing those with modern analytical techniques. And this year, 2021, we will finish all of the stream sediments from the same area. And we are going to make the geology maps, the stream sediment data, and the geophysical data all available through our portal, through our website. And it's going to be really, really neat. I'm really excited about it. It's going to be a great tool for attracting industry, because they'll be able to see the kind of data that we have, and they'll be able to see where the metal concentrations are. But it'll also be a great tool for the small prospector, because they typically do not have the software and the capacity to handle these large data sets and to view the data geographically. So a prospector would be able to get on here and turn on all the tin values and go see where the tin occurs, or turn on all the chrome values and see where the chrome occurs, or gold or zinc or rare earth elements. And I think that's going to be a very well-received data layer, and I'm completely excited about that.
Good. Well, please continue.
Yes, next slide, please. This is slide 18, which is titled EO 13953. And this is, excuse me, let me just take a drink of water here. This is the second executive order that was issued by the Trump administration. This one was issued in September of 2020, so much more recently, and really speaks to measures or additional measures to incentivize and support the production of critical minerals domestically. One of the interesting things about this executive order is it declared a national emergency to deal with the nation's dependence on critical minerals, and that freed up some capacity within the federal government to address this issue. So the report requires the collective heads of federal agencies to report to the president every 6 months on the threat, and requires the heads of all relevant agencies to submit a report that details that agency's strategy for using their authority and appropriations to meet these goals. The executive order also calls for determination whether a previous executive order on the National Defense Resource Preparedness would allow a program to be established to provide grants to procure or install production equipment for the production and processing of critical minerals in the United States. And that is, I think, where this critical minerals executive order ties directly into the mining operations and the recovery of critical minerals from those mining operations that are currently in production. This executive order also calls for the heads of all relevant agencies to use their authority to accelerate the issuance of permits and the completion of projects that could occur in the connection with expanding and protecting the domestic supply chain for minerals. So it also directs the Interior Energy and EPA agencies to look at accelerating production of critical minerals from mine tailings and abandoned mine sites. And again, that speaks, I believe, to Senator Keel's question about, you know, are we looking at this? Well, here's the executive order that's mandating that. So there's a lot of good things in here. There's something else that, you know, that ties into the permitting here is FAST 41. And that is something that I'm not particularly familiar with, but Commissioner Feige may be able to speak to that particular issue.
Great. And thank you for that, Steve. And just back on the record, this is Corey Feige. As we look at EO 13953, which was put out by President Trump in September of 2020, this, as Steve has laid out, really focused on how we can streamline and speed up the timeline for mine development, especially as it comes to offsetting production that comes currently from adversarial nations like China. Within the framework of this EO, it tied into a couple of other actions that had been ongoing in the Trump White House last year. One was the modernization of the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, which was done in part through rulemaking and in part through an executive order by President Trump. And then we had what is called FAST 41. And FAST 41, the program actually goes back to, I believe it is 2015, and it was a federal statute that established rules around permitting of critical infrastructure. And so an office that we call FIPSI grew out of that statutory framework, and so did what we call the FAST 41 project. What the FAST 41 project means is that if you are a mine, and for example, Graphite 1, the project up on the Seward Peninsula for high-grade graphite, which can directly offset imports to the U.S. and to North America from China. It is North America's highest grade graphite deposit known to date and can directly offset that foreign import. So the Graphite One project achieved FAST 41 ranking status through that federal program, and we will now be watching under the Biden administration, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a couple of slides, where we think some of these programs are going to go. Certainly, the executive order that established a lot of the streamlining for both National Environmental Policy Act, those are your EISs and your EAs, those reviews, as well as the FAST 41, have those EOs that Trump promulgated have been repealed or revoked by President Biden. However, both National Environmental Policy Act and some of the changes had already been achieved through rulemaking, as well as the basis of the FAST 41 project in statute. So we'll be watching very closely to see what aspects of FAST 41 and NEPA modernization move forward. Obviously, from a policy standpoint, we are not hearing from the Biden administration that they will be significantly softening their approach to China or other adversarial nations that currently control the minerals markets, especially around critical minerals and things like rare earths. So we're watching very hopefully and looking at the personnel coming back into the Biden interior. There is a pro-mining group there, and so I think at least at this point that it makes me cautiously optimistic about where we will go with FAST 41 and some streamlined NEPA approach or National Environmental Policy Act approach as we move forward with the Biden policies.
Thank you, Commissioner Feige. That is good to hear. Any questions? No, I'd like, please let the record reflect that we've been joined by Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue, Mr. Masterman.
Yes, thank you, Senator Rivek. If we could, for the record again, my name is Steve Masterman, Director of Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. If we could move on to the next slide, if there are no further questions on this one, it would be slide 19, titled Department of Energy. And as I mentioned a couple of times, the Department of Energy has taken what appears to be a fairly aggressive move into the critical minerals sphere. And one might think that this is something that is outside of their jurisdiction, and perhaps it is, but they are quite a remarkable group of folks. They have very deep pockets and have made some very fundamental advances in other parts of, you know, the natural resource industry, particularly sort of the fracking development. So their engagement here in critical minerals could be a very significant development. They appear to be moving into the, the realm that was formerly occupied by the U.S. Bureau of Mines before it was disbanded, and are looking at technological changes, research and development into extractive technologies, innovative processing, disruptive processing technologies to address the recovery of critical minerals from any and all possible sources. So about 6 months ago, they put out a proposal, a funding proposal, and to look at rare earths and critical minerals associated with carbon ores. And that's the first bullet here, the Core CM funding opportunity. And in that, they're really looking at you know, what are the opportunities to produce critical minerals in conjunction with coal or in conjunction with oil and gas? And so they wanted to assess a number of sedimentary basins around the country, and Alaska was one of the sedimentary basins that they called out to assess. And we know there's more than one sedimentary basin in Alaska, but for the purposes of DOE, they put the whole state together. This is a pretty significant opportunity, and University of Alaska, University of Anchorage as well, and ourselves pulled a team of people together and submitted an application for almost $2 million for phase one, which was really to characterize the critical minerals associated with coal and oil and gas fields across Alaska. If we're successful, there are future phases which then call for technological developments and research technologies to try to recover those metals that are identified in this first phase. So phase one is basically a characterization, and then phase two and phase three, there would be some down selection to advance to more metallurgical extractive development through the university. So we're hopeful. Another subsequent to that, and the Department of Energy issued a request for information after holding a workshop in November, which I attended, and they sent me a copy of the request for information. And the main 4 points they're looking for are right there in that second bullet. And this, I think, is is telling us the direction that they are looking at going with their research and development activities. So the first bullet is resource characterization, and that's really, you know, what technologies can we develop to speed up the mapping of our country. So, you know, what technologies and characterization activities can we do to better understand critical mineral deposits? And so that's definitely in DGGS's wheelhouse. Sustainable resource extraction and beneficial technology development. Here they're looking, you know, what new technologies can be deployed to assist with the extraction of critical minerals across all resource industries, whether it's mining or oil and gas or coal. And a little bit different but similar on the extractive metallurgy and alloying technology. So, and then international standards, engagement, supply chain development. There's a lot here that we're trying to pull together a response to this from university folks, ourselves. We've reached out to the AMA and RDC. We have UCOR involved. We're reaching out to Graphite One and some of the other miners in the state to get their input here, because if we can point DOE in the appropriate direction, then DOE will focus their efforts on research and development activities that are beneficial to Alaska and to our own mining and energy industries.
Thank you, Mr. Masterman. We do have a question from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Masterman, interesting, this grant application to look for the rare earths in coal basins, that it perked up my ears. Everything in the presentation thus far has really been about rare earths in hard rock, pretty much. I mean, all your slides previous have talked about co-location with gold and co-location with zinc. Is this because there's just a whole other set of rare earths that we always find or often find with coal and sedimentary basins, and you just didn't have time to get to them? Or is this because we're looking for something we haven't found before, but wouldn't it be cool?
Through the chair, excellent question, Senator Keel. This is basically a different geological environment. You know, most of our mineral deposits occur in igneous and metamorphic rocks in the uplands, in granites and in schists and gneisses and in veins contained in those. When you get into sedimentary basins, you're into a whole different geological environment, and particularly with rare earths. Rare earths are a group of 17 different elements. It's not just one element, it's 17 different elements, and they all behave somewhat differently in the superficial environment. So in the case of a sedimentary basin, and I forgive me for getting a little nerdy here, but so like in Alaska, we have upland areas that contain rare earth elements. We have volcanoes that are putting out rare earth elements in the ash. Those rare earth elements get into the streams, they get into the water systems, and they are transported down into the sedimentary basins. And when they're in those sedimentary basins, the organic components, like the coal, can leach those metals out of solution, and the clays that are deposited, you know, the fine-grained sediments can also leach those metals out of solution. So there are situations where the coal itself or the fine-grained associated sediments can be enriched in rare earths or other critical minerals. And so typically they're not present in quantities that by themselves would be economic, but as a byproduction of the coal, or of the other, you know, say oil and gas, if you can get it out of the water that's associated with producing oil and gas, then there may be opportunities to recover critical minerals from environments that are sort of atypical, I guess, from a geological standpoint.
Thank you.
Thank you. We only have a few minutes left, so if you could please continue maybe through the rest of the presentation, and we'll save our questions to the end.
Great. I just have one more point on this slide, and then I'll be done. So very recently, actually it was right around Christmas time, the Department of Energy established an Office of Mineral Stability, or Sustainability rather. And this was funded, I believe, at $800 million level. And this is the organization that will be conducting the research into producing critical minerals from these alternative methods. And so this is the organization that we are aiming our response to for the request for information. So it's really an encouraging development that the federal government is pursuing this line of investigation. And hopefully we can get the DOE to aim some of its funding at the University of Alaska in particular, but as a state as well. So I think that's my last slide, and unless there are any questions, I will turn it over to Commissioner Feige for the last couple of slides.
Hey, thank you, Steve. And hearing none, we'll go back on the record. This is Corey Feige, Commissioner of DNR. So looking just very quickly now at slide 20 and 21. So on slide 20, what we wanted to do was to encapsulate for members of the committee and for the public some of the Biden administration's stated goals and the implications that we believe that has for Alaska's mineral sector and mining. Clearly, the Biden administration's heavy focus on renewable energy targets are going to have massive implications for advanced materials, critical mineral and rare earth development. Things like building electric vehicles and converting electric systems in buildings to capture the efficiencies. All of that points toward new digital technologies, new digital instrumentation, and all of that relies heavily upon minerals. The Made in America Build Back Better initiative, while it hasn't singled out mining, they do highlight a focus on that industrial, the domestic industry and manufacturing. Again, renewables infrastructure takes a tremendous amount of minerals to just build the infrastructure. Batteries, electric vehicles, communications infrastructure, et cetera. And so far, we have not seen the same kind of anti-fossil fuel rhetoric out of the new administration as we have, unfortunately, on the oil and gas side. So I think with the focus toward the massive amounts of investment and the massive amounts of advancement in the infrastructure and the technology that's going to need to take place to deliver President Biden's agenda, I think that bodes well for the mineral industry generally and certainly for Alaska due to our endowment. And so moving finally to the last slide, slide 21, we still have a fair bit of uncertainty and some challenges ahead of us with the Biden administration, even where mining and minerals development is concerned. I mentioned earlier the resistance to the National Environmental Policy Act streamlining and the FAST 41 permitting reforms. We're going to be watching those very closely. Clearly, the 30 by 30 initiative, wherein the administration has stated the goal of placing into conservation units 30% of the nation's land and the nation's water by 2030, gives one great pause when you're in Alaska, and we already have in excess of 160 million acres tied up in conservation or park units in the state. And so we will be pointing to ANILCA and the No More Clause at every turn and reminding our federal partners that Alaska has already paid its due where conservation units are concerned. The support for increased corporate taxes and for potentially new federal mining royalties and other commercial challenges, we likewise will be watching those very closely because these go directly to, as you all know, the project economics. And here in Alaska, where we already face higher operating costs, higher production and development costs simply by nature of where we sit on the globe and our lack of infrastructure, things like higher power costs, we'll be looking for every opportunity to find solutions along this path for our operators as well. And then finally, again, I stated a little earlier, I think one thing that does bode well for us is that personnel is policy. And many of the leaders and the staff in the new administration have come back in from the Obama administration. And even during that time period, they were historically supportive of not only mining operations, some of them certainly for mining restrictions. And that goes back to the FAST 41 and the National Environmental Policy Act. But I think on balance, if they're going to meet the renewables energy goal and their other modernization goals as they see it, they're going to rely very heavily on a domestic mining industry. And so with that, we'll leave you with the slides. I'm conscious of the time and open the floor for questions.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Stevens.
Well, this is fascinating, and I really appreciate, Commissioner, your comments. And the importance of reaching these energy goals. Are there are there things we can do? I mean, I understand what you're saying is we depend on the Biden administration, depend on the federal government to move ahead and assist, but are there things that we should be doing? I'm thinking in terms of credits, of tax assistance. Are you contemplating anything in those areas?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, thank you for that. While I haven't contemplated credits or things of that nature, I do believe that there are things that the Alaska legislature certainly can do. I believe that it's going to be important for the state of Alaska. We talked about this last time with this notion of listening to the science. It's going to be very important for the state of Alaska to establish what it is we believe is acceptable in the way of good, robust science, because that robust science underpins all of our permitting decisions. It will need to underpin all of the federal rulemaking and actions. And where we sit today, we don't have an established bar, so to speak. We all know what that is from a functional standpoint, but it's not stated anywhere. And I believe that that's very important. I believe it's also important that we really lean in with our federal partners and we let them know that Alaska can contribute significantly to the modernization and to the development and expansion of renewable resources. And those kinds of discussions through Energy Council and some of the other councils that the legislature participates in, I think messaging that is going to be very important.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Feige and Director Masterman. I couldn't agree more. We really appreciate this update. We will be leaning in, I think, and I'm glad you brought up ANILCA and the No More Clause on Monday. We will have some ANILCA training on just that. And so I think we've reached our time here. I appreciate everybody hanging in there. Again, thank you. I'm sure we'll have you guys back in the future. We really appreciate you being here with us. So with that, everybody, thank you for time and attention. Hope you all have a great meeting. This committee is adjourned at 5:01 p.m.